Session number 5201, reel 4.
Wartime filming, Martin Gray, reel 4.
So Churchill decided to press on without the escort, and we have kept 15 to 18 knots, and it was. But he decided that he brought 12, I think it was something like 12 feature films, American ones, which he'd got, because he was a film buff and he loved his movies. And he decided that he was going to see a movie every night. Doesn't matter what the weather was like, he was going to see it every night. So, which I think was a good thing, because it kept everybody amused. And he used to sit down in the wardroom with the in his armchair, where the Marine used to come in with the brandy bottle and glasses, filling up the brandy in between reels. And the projector was strung up in the doorway of the wardroom, lashed together. And in the middle of the film one night, the projector suddenly, the picture disappeared, and the projector suddenly, with a violent lurch, went straight the way down the from the wardroom into the galley. Anyway, they pulled it back and filled it up, and Churchill had another brandy, and we watched films all the way across the Atlantic. But it was like hanging on from grim death, because it was bucketing around. Anyway, we got the other side, Chesapeake Bay, we went aground, and we had tug. They were going to bring us a tug to pull us off, and the tugs arrived, but we managed to get off ourselves. But we churned up an awful lot of mud in the process. Anyway, we went into Washington, and when we got to Washington, we went by train from Norfolk to Virginia to Washington in my train, and then we were taken over by the American press corps, who proceeded to look after us, the six of us, like Dutch uncles. They took us everywhere. There were always cars to take us wherever we wanted to go. There wasn't much to do, because Churchill and Roosevelt and their advisors were all closeted together, and they weren't giving pictures to anybody, the American press or us. And the American press were howling even louder than we were about it. And eventually there was a press call, but I wasn't invited, because it was a still and silent picture stuff. And my first thing I had to do was when Churchill addressed Congress. This was the first time that a foreign film crew of any sort had been allowed inside the Congress to film. And of course it was the first time that any premier, such as Churchill, would have been allowed to address Congress. And it was an absolute magnificent occasion, because the ovation that he got at the end of his speech, well, I don't think I've ever seen anything like it before. They just went wild.
Was this easy to record?
Oh, yes. He's a very easy man to record. His voice is nice and clear and concise, and he doesn't mumble in his beard at all. He just gets on with it, and out it comes. Oh, yes, he's an easy man to record.
And the sibilance is not a problem?
No great problem, no. You don't take any notice of it. It's not serious. And then, of course, we there went from up on the President's train. He gave the President's train to Churchill to take us all up, and the American press up to Canada, where he there addressed the Canadian Parliament. And, of course, out of that came the famous remarks of his, in which he called Mussolini a jackal. And when he mentioned Mussolini, said that we were like chicken, having to have necks wrung. He said, some chicken, some neck, and this sort of thing. And this is the only time I've ever recorded in Parliament. I've been in Parliament, because I filmed the present Parliament when it was rebuilt, after it was rebuilt, as a cameraman, when it was rebuilt, and they allowed one still cameraman and one movie cameraman, and I happened to be the rotor cameraman to do it, to film the chamber before it was used, the present one they use now. That's the only time movie cameras ever been in there. And to this day, if you will notice, that there are no television cameras in there yet. And then when we then went back, came back to New York, to Washington, and our New York office had been trying to get us to go up to New York, because they wanted to have us up in New York, but we couldn't get away, because we couldn't believe they wouldn't let us go away for 2 or 3 days because they didn't know what was going to happen. Anyway, we came back on the train that night, and it was New Year's Eve, and everybody was having a good time down in the club bar. There was a big club coach at the end of the train, and the message came down that Churchill wanted to see everybody in the dining room. So this was, I suppose, about 11:45. And we all trooped up there. Most of us took drinks with us. And about 11:55, in strolled the old man. The first time he'd been seen in public in a siren suit, with a brand new cigar on, and he walked in and the American, and his slippers on, and the Americans just fell about, and he stopped and talked to them all and chatted away to everybody, beaming cherubic face and loving every moment of anyone. And he suddenly said, as it turns, "Well, gentlemen," he said, "here's to the successful conclusion of the war, and there's no doubt about it, we're going to win it. Toast to the end of the war." Everybody drank up. He said, "Well, have a good evening. Good night, everybody," and away he went. And of course, the American press, oh dear, you've never seen anything like it in life. They thought the end had come, that the old man had come, bothered to come down and see them and got them all together. Of course, we went back to the club car and then proceeded to drink the rest of the night away. But it was fabulous. And then, of course, all of a sudden, we were whisked out of Washington without any ado. All of a sudden, we were all told to leave immediately, and we all left. And we were taken down to back to Norfolk. We were then flew by flying boat to Bermuda. And Paul flew with Churchill, and I flew on the second plane because, I mean, there was no point in me. He wanted a photographer up there, and Paul bullied them to let him go as well. And he got the pictures of him and sitting in the seat and flying the plane, ostensibly flying the plane, but I think he probably was, but with his cigar on, which the captain nearly had kittens over. But anyway, we eventually finished up back in Bermuda, and he then flew on. He decided that he had to get back, and he then decided he would fly on, and everybody was against him flying on. They didn't think that the plane, you know, had just about enough range to do it, and that he shouldn't do it. But he said, "No, I must get back." So they flew him back, and we all came back on the Duke of York. Very comfortable and quiet trip back. The sea was like glass.
After your return, what experience did you have of filming either with the Air Force or the Navy in Britain?
None with the Navy at all. I didn't have anything to do with the Navy right throughout the war, except to be ferried around by them a couple of times. But with the Air Force, very little with the RAF. But with the American Air Force, I was going to go on a daylight raid with them, recording the intercom conversation and the general sound, if I could get any, but the intercom conversation mainly, of the aircraft during the raid, before and afterwards. And if they were attacked, you know, where the plane, and hear the intercom conversation of what was going on. But it took quite a bit of getting organised, because the intercoms were not very distinct anyway. And to try and marry in the sound equipment into the intercom was presented quite a bit of a problem in those days. It would have been very easy now, but at that time it wasn't very, very easy, and we had certain problems with it, and it took a bit longer than I expected. And anyway, they weren't ready to fly me at that time. I went up several times with them.
Can you
checking
recall
it out.
These problems?
Yes, it was a problem, basically, of marrying up your one type of system. It's to go into it, it's a bit too technical, but to marry up a system which is, shall we say, low key, and one is high key, to give you just a rough idea. It isn't that, but roughly that. And to get the right amount of dropping resistance is made up in order to balance the thing out so that you finish up with an intelligible sound as opposed to a jumble of nothing or a jumble which you couldn't understand because of the mismatch of sound. It's a mismatch, basically. All microphones and all loudspeakers and amplifiers and everything have to be matched so that they give a true sound, and this basically was the problem. And I flew several times with them in order to try it out. It was no good going on the ground. You had to do it in the air. We'd try it out on the ground and take it, go up with them and try it out there. Because once you got up top, it was, for some reason or other, it was totally different to when you were down on the ground. I don't know why, to this day. But anyway, when I was more or less ready to go, two of the cameramen who were assigned flew with them on a couple of sorties, and after the second time, Lewis, a man called Lewis of Paramount, he didn't return off a raid. He was lost. And for some reason, the American authorities just clamped down on it. And I never did fly. I'm not sorry, because I think it could have been a bit hairy, to say the least of it. But I would have enjoyed doing it, and I wanted to do it. But looking back on it now, I'm not sorry.
This was from Bassingbourne.
Yes, this was Bassingbourne near Royston in Hertfordshire. I spent quite a lot of time there with Jack Ramsden, basically. We spent quite a lot of time there. And after that, I did the usual run-of-the-mill things around the place, travelling up and down the country in the blackout with no lights. All very difficult. And that's probably why I wear glasses nowadays.
Were you working with Paul Byrne by this time?
No, I wasn't, no. I didn't start to work with Paul until... by 43 I was working with Paul, yes. By 43 I was, 1943. And we were eventually then... They decided that Movie Tone put up the idea that they wanted to send a sound crew over to Italy, in actual fact. Mainly because they wanted to get an interview with the Pope when Italy was eventually liberated, as they all thought it was going to be in double quick time. Anyway, we sorted ourselves out and got all the equipment and everything together, and I drove the car up to Stornoway. Stornoway.
That's on Orkney.
No, not Stornoway, not Orkney, no. What's the other name of the other place? Doesn't matter. Anyway, an out-of-the-way port, which is on the mainland. It wasn't on the... I can't think of the name of it now. And left the car there, and it was to go on an American Liberty ship. And we were to join... We then went up a train and joined the ship in Gourock with the convoy. And the ship, of course, was a Liberty ship, and it was the crew. The captain was a naturalised Norwegian, American-Norwegian, 6'5", could hardly, spoke terribly broken American. And, of course, the ship was dry. And he called us up to his cabin one first day out. He said, you're not feeling very well. We said, no, we're feeling fine, sir, thank you. He said, no. He said, I think you need some medicine. So we said, oh, yes. He said, well, he says, I have a medicine chest. And he opened the chest. There was a case of scotch there. And he said, I think you better have some medicine for the trip. He said, I can't give you any more, but there's a bottle each for you. He said, make it last the trip. We said, how long is it going to be? He said, oh, well, I think about 3 weeks. So we measured this whiskey out, and it just lasted us for 3 weeks. But it was a fabulous trip because we didn't know it, but the ship was carrying explosives, and then we were looking at the stretch out of the convoy, and we said, well, why red ships? And they said, well, they're the ones carrying explosives. And we said, oh, God, so we. He said, yes. The car was in the hold down below. Anyway, we didn't know where we were going. We knew we were going to Italy, but eventually we knew we were going to Italy. But we didn't know what part of Italy we were going to, and the captain had his orders sealed and was not to open them till he was in the Mediterranean. We knew we were going into the Med because of the, it's fairly obvious. And I learnt how to decode all the signals from the Commodore to all the ships, because it was all flags. And I busied myself with this, because there was no filming to be done. We hadn't got any equipment or anything. It was all in the hold. Well, there wasn't much filming to do anyway, you know, because the convoy, quite fascinating. The convoy would be all nice and tight together at dusk, come the morning, and if you were up early in the morning, it was scattered all over the place. You probably hadn't got a ship within 3 miles of you. You were on your own, virtually, or you could see one over there and one over there, little tiny things. And gradually it all came back together again, all shepherded back in by the escort vessels. I don't forget that. Eventually we got down and the buzz went round that we were going either to Bari or to Naples. And then suddenly we heard that there had been a vast explosion and we didn't know where it was. But it turned out to be the great big ammunition explosion in Bari Harbour. But we actually finished up in Naples. We went into Naples and we were off in Naples and went up to Caserta to the 5th Army. That's where we were supposed to go. And joined up with them there. And there started the history of a year in Italy. And we arrived there on Christmas Eve, I think it was.
What were the difficulties you had trying to film warfare with a sound van as large as your own?
Well, you must remember, it wasn't a van. It was a saloon car. It was a Humber saloon car. Ordinary standard saloon car of 1936 vintage, which we bought as a standby car to our own car, to our Sunbeam Talbots we had. And of course we lost one Sunbeam Talbot in France. And this was kitted out and fitted out for us, and we took this. And it was a civilian car all the time. And of course, although the army had Humber cars, they had different. Their car was different to ours. So anything that went wrong with their car, they hadn't got the parts for it to fit.
Was yours camouflaged?
Oh, yes. It was all camouflaged, yes. We had nothing, no numbers on it at all, and the army couldn't understand this. But we were free agents, you see. We could go anywhere we wanted. It didn't matter. We didn't have to have... And of course, with the American army, they didn't have conducting officers or anything like this. You were a war correspondent. If you were an American, you had a jeep with a driver. And if we'd wanted transport, they would have given it to us. But as we had our own transport, it didn't matter. We supplied petrol and all this sort of thing without a problem. Obviously, as much as you wanted. And you just then decided what you wanted to do. And if you wanted them to do anything for you, you used to ask them. They were much more... geared, and American is always more geared to the press than the British for some reason unknown. And if you wanted anything, they would always do their best to do it for you or get it sorted out. If you wanted an interview with General Mark Clark or something like this over something or other, they would try and organise it for you. And 9 cases out of 10, Clark would say yes, certainly for the Limeys. So he used to. And, I mean, he was always very friendly to us, and whenever he saw us, he always made a point of coming over and talking to us, because we stuck out like sore thumbs, a couple of Britishers in battle dress, and against all the Americans. It was an interesting exercise. The Americans are not nearly so geared as the British are in making do with what they've got. They have to have everything laid on, showers, Coca-Cola machines, laundries, all this sort of thing. Headquarters had to have everything. And they couldn't understand when we had Jim Wright with us, Eric Barrow, Paul and myself, and a couple of American cameramen, Paul Donahue and Griffiths, who was a still photographer, American AP still photographer. And we all shared the same tent. It was the big square tents. And they couldn't understand us because we always used to make things up. We always wanted fresh fruit. They never had any. We always had to go out and get ourselves oranges and this sort of thing. And we all had a great big box of oranges underneath the bed. And we always used to, of course they were dry. They weren't allowed any spirits at all. And we made friends with some nappy friend of ours back down the line a bit. And we used to go down to him and say, how's about some whiskey and We managed to pry some whiskey out of him. We shouldn't really, but because we had no ration as such, you see. We should have had a ration as a half British officer. But not being attached to a British unit, we couldn't get it. We got it, let's face it. But when with the Americans, we had problems with them and the PX, because being British, they didn't really want to let us into the PX. But luckily for us, we made friends with the lieutenant who ran the PX. So he said, well, what do you want? He said, we only want some cigarettes and cigars or a bit of chocolate or something like that. We don't want any clothes or anything like that. Oh, he said, any time you want, come in and see me. I'll give it to you. And of course, he ladled out cartons of cigarettes and Paul smoked cigars all the time and gave him King Edward cigars and what have you. And it was all great fun, but it was hard living. They could never make the best of the fact it was a very bad winter. It was very wet. Mud up to your eyebrows all the time. And they could never get around to the fact of putting down duckboards and this sort of thing to try and make life easy for people. You literally had to squelch your way around in the mud all the time.
Why did you stay with the Americans when...
Well, this is where we were assigned to. Because the Americans were on the southern coast and the 8th Army were on the north side. And the 8th Army were covered, as far as the British were concerned. But the American Army initially was not covered as far as we were concerned, and we could operate between the two. But we were stationed with the 5th Army, but we could go over to the 8th if we wanted to, or to do anything, or we were frequently sent over to the 8th to do some recording and this sort of thing. But we were basically with the 5th Army, and this is, I think we were the Galignano River was the first river that the first attack, artillery barrage attack, I think, that was ever filmed
with sound
and all everything that went with it. And I think that was the occasion, I can't remember it exactly, but I think it was that occasion we set up, no, it was another occasion on a similar sort of thing. We set up on a gun and during the daylight and to get the gunfire at night over the 7.2 howitzer. And everyone said, right, we're firing shortly. And the officer said, right, everybody stand by. Fire! Nothing happened, you see. And all of a sudden, this officer said, fire! Nothing happened. What's the matter? I said, the fucking lanyard smoke. And the folks said to me, behind him, he said, shh, movie tone. Oh, he said, bugger movie tone too. All in the dark, you know, and it's all on film now. But it was great fun. We did the casino thing, I think, was the most interesting thing of the lot. Because, I mean, through Italy, we did all the usual things, all the various things and so on. And, of course, prior to casino, we looked up one night out of the tent and the whole of the sky was lit up, very bright pink. And we said, what's about that? And somebody said to us, we hear Vesuvius has erupted. There is it. So being free agents, we hightailed it straight back down to Naples, and sure enough, there was Vesuvius and all its glory going wonderfully. I'd never seen such a sight in my life. It was incredible. And the dust and the ash, we filmed it. We filmed the people, the lava stream, put the car up against the stream on the side of it. The heat from it was terrific. They're wonderful pictures, but unfortunately they were in black and white. We had no colour in those days. And it was all in black and white, and the sound of all the lava stream when it was cooling, all the clinker going like this, was quite incredible. And having done that, we then went back up again. And of course, our next thing was, as I was going to say, was casino. The bombing of the Abbey. We knew this was going to happen because it was a German outlook post. And of course, casino, everybody was bogged down by casino at that time. Nobody could get round it. And it was holding up the whole thing. And we'd waited 3 weeks for the bombing of this casino. And every day we used to dive up and down this road, which we were told had a gun on the end of it, but never fired at us. And when it was due to happen, we'd given it up. We said, well, we can't wait any longer. We'd better go back to base. So we went back to base. We'd only been back at base 2 days, and the breathless colonel of the American PR set up poked his head in the door and said, gentlemen, you've got 1 hour to get up to for the bombing of the Abbey. We said, Christ. So we shoved everything on, didn't worry, the shave or anything, and dived out up the road. And, of course, the road was full of transport. Anyway, we did get there. We got there in time, and we managed to get set up before the thing started. But the thing always reminded me of this was we started filming as soon as the bombs left the aircraft, and, of course, it was 25 seconds before they hit the ground. And this was wasting an awful lot of film, about 45 feet of film a minute, so being 90 feet going through a camera at a minute, so we decided that we'd time it, and then when the bombs left, say, right, the bombs are gone, and then time it and switch on about 3 or 4 seconds before they were due to hit. And this is what we did. We saved an awful lot of film by doing it. Having done this, it's all, the rest is on the record, on celluloid, so to speak. But the noise was the other thing, was the interesting part. It was quite surprising. You saw the bombs hit the Abbey, and nothing, not a sound except the aeroplane in the sky, not a sound. And however long it took, well, what is it, 700 feet a second, is it? Or something like this. It took something like about 10 or 15 seconds for the sound to reach us. So you had the picture on the screen. So we're told when we saw it back, because they brought the sound up when they actually recorded it. But with the sound on the screen of the bombs going up like this, apparently all you could hear were the birds twittering. Because I put the microwave far enough away from the camera so that you couldn't hear the camera running. All you could hear were the birds twittering in the air all the way around. And they're all sudden, this light off. After that, the other one was these casino town when we nearly got when they were the same thing, we did the same thing again, but this time we got somebody else. I got fed up with timing it, and we had a little British Tommy with us who was, Jim Wright was with us at the time, I think it was Jim, but it was a little Tommy who was with us, and he said, I'll do it for you, sir. Paul says it's an American, but it isn't, it's a little British Tommy we had, and he said, I'll tie it for, and I happened to look up and he said, bomb's gone, sir. And they were over there. I said, that's us. Everybody down. Which it was. I mean, if there'd been one more bomb, it'd been straight on the top of us. We were right bang in the line. But that was the only... They bombed everything. They bombed the headquarters, Monty's headquarters. They bombed the New Zealand guns. This was the Americans, I might say. They bombed everything bar casino. Anyway, after that, we went back. We got called to... called back, we were in Florence, and said, go back to Naples and get ready to go in on the South of France landing. And we waited and waited, and eventually we went on an LST, an American LST. And we were taken into Marseille, having had over, what, a year in Italy, just about a year, and taken into Marseille, and of course it was all liberated then, the landing had gone through and everything else. And they'd sort of swanned up the Rhone Valley without any problem whatsoever. And we just drove up the Rhone Valley as if it was, except for a bit of damage here and there, not much. And we swung to Luxeuil. Well, we caught up with everybody, and there, of course, waiting for us was a cable said, come back to England, refit, ready to go to the second front.